Cutting Audio. Deathlands.
Here it comes!
Outlanders.
Warning, meltdown imminent.
The Executioner.
Tag, you're it.
Stony Man.
Brace for impact!
Now playing at the theater in your mind.
Evening hung dead still and oppressively humid over the shallow, 5-acre, seep-fed lake. The lavender dome of sky perfectly reflected in its mercury-smooth surface. Encircling the muddy bank was a fringe of stripped, bleached skeletons of trees. The intense quiet was neither peaceful nor serene. The very air seemed to vibrate in anticipation and dread. Terrible forces of nature were about to make themselves known. From the north end of the lake came a rhythmic sound, not a bird nor an insect. Sensing the impending hell, the birds and insects had gone to ground. A tall human figure stood on the bank in hip boots, waving a 9-foot-long rod back and forth. As he did so, he sailed a bright yellow line through the air, forward and back, in a tight loop, out over the purple mirror of sky. He wore a long, pointy, black goatee. His black hair was loosely tied in a ponytail, which hung to the middle of his back. On his head was a tatter-brimmed straw cowboy hat. His eyes were hidden behind wraparound sunglasses. His face was long, gaunt, perhaps tragic, certainly suffering, certainly world-weary. As he cast, the water swirled and gurgled. The head of a huge, muddy lungfish appeared in the middle of the ripples. It looked up at the man, then struggled out of the pool, walking on the bony spikes of its pectoral fins. Greenish-gray on the back, with a light cream-colored belly, the mutie was easily 5 feet long and more than 60 pounds. As it dragged itself from the world of fish into that of man's, its large, rubbery mouth and gill covers opened and closed, breathing air. Grunting from the effort, the lungfish crawled up beside the man. An odor rose up along with it, the smell of a slaughterhouse in August.
You have no fly on the end of your line. You can't catch anything that way.
I'm not fishing for anything.
You're fishing for nothing?
That's right.
Are you catching any?
I'm catching and releasing nothing.
As the man continued casting, to his left, a 2-wheeled cart drawn by 3 men appeared over the rim of the slope. The lake sat on a stair-step rise. Above it was mountainside. Below it, the ground, mostly bare, eroded limestone, angled 300 feet down to a broad flat spot between surrounding peaks. There, in a grove of low, scrubby trees, stood the remote ville. Even by Deathland standards, it was a scab-assed place. Dirt floor shacks and lean-tos built up against the outer wall of the ville's only permanent structure, a pre-dark concrete blockhouse. Most of these shanties were big enough to house 1 or 2 people. Not tall enough to stand in, though. The 3 men took axes and a heavy bladed machete from the cart and started hacking away at its contents. They thoroughly enjoyed spraying one another with flying gore. After a few minutes of extreme effort, they paused to catch their breath, then started throwing human arms, legs, and quartered torsos into the water. The erratic splashes broke the metronomic sounds of the fly rod. The lungfish turned back from the commotion.
Am I real to you?
The man let his line fall and settle. He pushed his sunglasses down the bridge of his nose and looked at the talking fish.
Nothing is real.
As more body parts landed in the pool, swirls appeared in the water near the splashes. Other lungfish were rising to feed.
That dinner looks pretty real to me. Eat my body, become my body.
Yeah.
The lungfish began slithering back to the water and its share of chow.
Try some bait next time, Baron Kerr. You may actually catch something.
The bearded man remained silent and threw a loop into his floating line that allowed him to sweep the whole length of it back into the air. Suddenly, the entire pool's surface shivered before him, the lavender mirror shattering into a billion fragments. Like glittering confetti, the first spores of the evening lifted gracefully into the air. This was just the overture. In seconds, dense clouds of the free genetic material boiled up from the water.
Oh, shit. Here it comes.
Pale green fingers of fire crackled and sparked from the pool's undulating surface, making the clouds glow and shimmer from within. As the mini-storm grew in intensity, the blood-spattered men hurried down the slope with their empty cart, determined to get under cover before sporefall. The heat from the electrical discharge made the air temperature jump 25 degrees and sent the spore clouds billowing upward. The higher they rose, the more ferocious the strange lightning storm became. Blistering, eye-aching bolts fired up from earth to sky, the prodigious thunder rattling the ground. Baron Jim Kerr quickly wound in his line and headed downhill for cover. He recognized the evening's ominous signs. The much heavier than normal spore hatch. The absolute frenzy of bioelectric discharge. That told him the food supply was dwindling, even now barely sufficient for survival. Something would have to be done, and soon. He knew better than to frustrate the burning pool. He remembered what had happened the last time. Cutting Audio presents James Axler's Deathlands. Narrated by Richard Rowan. With performances by Nanette Savard, Terrence Aselford, Timberlee Chanel, Christopher Walker, Kate Torrey, and Thomas Penny. Deathlands 62. Damnation Roadshow. A little girl in a faded cotton dress sat atop Bullardville's dirt and concrete defensive berm, watching distant plumes of yellow dust spiral up from the vast barren floodplain. Man-made tornadoes, backlit by the hard glare of the late afternoon sun. She sat with her skinny, sun-browned legs drawn up, her elbows propped on scabbed knees. The hand-me-down garment she wore was way too big for her. Every time she moved, it slipped off one or the other of her thin shoulders. During the hour that Lilu Bunny had been keeping vigil, the Ville's other children had joined her at intervals, scrambling up the backside of the berm for a look-see. After less than a minute of quiet reconnoiter, the pushing and pinching started. Squealing, they raced back down to resume their frantic, shrill game of Chill the Muty. Only Lilu had the patience to stay, to sit in silence and allow the promised miracle to unfold. She wanted to be first to see it and be able to remember every second. Nothing this exciting had ever happened in Bullardville. It was one of the most dramatic moments in Lilu's 8 years of life. It towered above, sneaking peeks through the windows of the gaudy house to see the mostly naked men and women fight on the pallets laid on the floor. Lilu had sometimes watched her own ma, Tater Bunny, fight on those mattresses. One of Tater's adversaries had probably been Lilu's father. There had been a lot of donors, but no one had ever stepped forward to claim the girl as his own. Because Lilu didn't fully understand the aim of the mattress fights, she had yet to figure out how to judge winners from losers. To her, it seemed the combatants usually parted on friendly, if not affectionate, terms. Some women fought 10 or 12 men a night and didn't seem the worse for wear, at least not any place that showed. It was a different story for her ma. Tater Bunny had died more than a year ago, when a drunken drifter had choked her a bit too hard. The man had tried to run away afterward, but the Ville's menfolk caught him and dragged him back. They hanged him from an old basketball stanchion, with his pants pulled down around his boots, and his willy sticking out. Lilu had sometimes gone to look at him, through the hot, blurry screen of her own tears, and threw rocks as hard as she could. After a while, she had to stand upwind, because the smell got so bad. The Ville's men cut down and buried the corpse eventually, when they needed the stanchion to hang someone else. The girl had no interest in following in her ma's footsteps. It was too confining. Lilu liked to be outdoors in the sun, not indoors, lying in tangled, sticky bedding. She liked planting seeds in the raised beds under sheet metal awnings and tending the young plants until they grew big enough to eat. She liked picking bouquets of wild daisies that seemed to pop up everywhere. She made delicate ornaments out of them by knotting the stems together. Today, she was decked out with a daisy circlet crown, and tiers of bracelets dangled from her slender wrists.